Okay. Tao's talk was, in some ways, a good introduction to this, but I want to get away from having to figure out what expected output should be. I want somebody else to do the work. In particular, I'd like to get users to do the work. Obviously, most of you, all of you, I'm sure, have run into automatic crash reporting mechanisms in application software. They've become quite commonplace in the last few years. Basically, if you click the OK button, what happens is that a crash report is sent back to the developer organization along with some kind of debug information. In the case of Microsoft, it's a Watson mini dump. And basically, organizations use that for grouping together related failures, crashes, and hangs, and for prioritizing them. The Microsoft, for example, works first on the bugs that cause the most crashes. Surprisingly, you don't see these kind of mechanisms very often, if at all, for soft failures, for non-crashing failures, which are obviously a big concern to software developers, as Tao pointed out. If there were to be such mechanisms, it would enable a lot of interesting developments in software engineering. This amounts to using users as your oracles. There's a lot of work going on in the research community on techniques for automatically classifying software failures, grouping related failures, on automatic fault localization, statistical debugging. In the next few years, you're likely to see some very nice developments in those techniques. Coupled together with this kind of user failure reporting, you have a potentially very powerful mechanism, because essentially the user labels, the user failure reports, enable you to use supervised learning in order to help do things like failure classification, fault localization. So it's a potentially very powerful combination. Well, why aren't people doing this? One reason is that developers don't trust users. They consider them to be very unreliable oracles. And this is anecdotal, but I've talked to developers who say exactly this, including people from Microsoft. Why are they unreliable? Well, they're not professional developers. They're not paid to do it. They are not highly motivated to do it, and they get confused. They don't always understand the product that well. Consequently, they will sometimes overlook real failures of the software. On the other hand, they'll sometimes report spurious failures, particularly because they misunderstand product functionality, and they think the software is not behaving correctly when in fact it is, at least to the eyes of the developer. Usability is another issue, of course. The bottom line is developers don't want to waste a lot of time investigating bogus problem reports from users. They have enough problems to work on. So what the research I'm going to talk about is getting some value out of this noisy feedback from users. Assume that you did have software equipped with a problem reporting button whereby a user could transmit a problem report whenever they saw what they considered to be erroneous behavior, not just crashes. I'm talking mainly about soft failures. And that would include, with that report would be some kind of profiling information which characterizes that execution, or possibly, and in my view, ideally, the execution would be captured and transmitted back to the developer. That would mean transmitting essentially transmitting the inputs that engendered that execution back to the developer. That raises privacy issues with consumer applications. With servers, it's not a problem because the developer controls the server. Okay, the first technique that I want to describe that we developed to address this, we call corroboration-based filtering. So the idea is to make use of user labels. So we're going to assume simply that users are labeling executions as successes or failures. When they press the problem report button, they're labeling an execution as a failure. When they don't do that, we're going to assume the execution is successful. Of course, that won't always be the case. This technique attempts to make up for the weaknesses of using users as oracles by corroborating their feedback. And essentially the idea is to pool the feedback that concerns similar executions in order to make a decision about what to do. And as in some of our previous work, we're going to rely on clustering executions, really clustering them based on execution profiles, detailed profiles that characterize the internal behavior of the software. And we're going to use measures of similarity and dissimilarity between those profiles in order to cluster them. So basically, two executions that are clustered together are going to have similar internal dynamics, program dynamics. And two executions that are far apart, or that are in different clusters, are going to have dissimilar execution dynamics. And the idea is we're going to ask developers to review, and this is where things like capture replay come in, they're going to need to be able to review some executions. But we don't want to waste their time, we want to direct them to suspicious executions or suspect executions. And basically with CBF, corroboration-based filtering, they're going to look at all executions that are labeled failure. They're going to look at executions that are close to failures that have already been confirmed as real failures. And they're going to also look at failures that have unusual profiles, very unusual profiles, whether or not they are labeled failure by users. Now, this is a conservative technique in the sense that it considers that failures are extremely serious, potential failures, and they have to be investigated. That may not be the case with consumer products. You may want to raise the bar, and I'll talk about that a little bit more at the end of the talk. You may not want to bother to investigate a failure unless there's lots of evidence that there's a problem. But here we're assuming you don't want to let failures go undiscovered. Okay, so basically you need to collect some data in order to use this technique. And there's four kinds of data you need. I said beta execution, but this applies to deployed software that's deployed in production as well. You need the user label, success or failure. You need an execution profile. You need some way of checking the execution, if necessary, for developers to check it to see if it actually failed or not. So you need either an I/O history, or you need to actually have captured the execution so that you can replay it and have the developers review it. And in case you want to debug the execution, if you confirm that it's a failure, you want some kind of diagnostic information, perhaps a history of internal events, event sequences, or better yet, capture replay, which would really facilitate debugging again. I'm not going to talk much about the relevant forms of profiling. It's discussed in a lot of our previous work and in other authors' work. But basically, the profile should reflect runtime events that are related to the causes and effects of failures. So, for example, things like function calls, basic block executions, conditional branches, predicate outcomes, etc. Okay, so these are the filtering rules for corroboration-based filtering. They're really quite simple. All executions that are in small clusters, that is, clusters with some size less than some threshold T, are reviewed. Now, in our experiments, we looked at different thresholds, but basically, I'll get to the punchline. T equals 1 is probably what you want to use for corroboration-based filtering, because you're gonna review these executions whether they're labeled failures or not by the users. So you don't want to review too many of them unless they're quite unusual. All executions that users have labeled failure are reviewed. And all executions that are in the same cluster with a confirmed failure are also reviewed. So if I have an execution in a cluster, it's labeled failure, I review it and I confirm that it's a real failure, then I'm going to look at all the other executions in that cluster on the assumption that very similar executions are more likely to be failures also. So we empirically evaluated corroboration-based filtering, and we looked at how effective it is in terms of the number of actual failures discovered, where we were actually able to confirm real failures, the number of underlying defects discovered, and we had to make an assumption here. Because of the way we did the experiments, which involved really thousands of replications, we weren't able to actually review all these millions of executions. So what we assumed is that if a failure was confirmed, then the developer, being a highly skilled developer, would always be able to find the defect. So we assumed a form of perfect debug. We also measured how costly the technique is in terms of the number of executions actually reviewed by developers, which is the main cost as we're concerned. Okay, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the experimental methodology, but let me point out a couple of things. We applied the technique to three open source subject programs, which we'll see in a minute. We randomly simulated user mislabeling of executions, and we did this so we could vary the mislabeling rate and see how the technique performed as the rate or probability of mislabeling by users increased. So in the first set of experiments that I'm going to describe, we varied it between 0 and 0.2, and in later experiments we got fancier, we varied it between 0 and 0.5, and we tried different mislabeling models. But initially here we're mislabeling all the executions with the same probability point, which is somewhere between 0 and 0.2, and we vary that systematically. We use three different clusterings where the total number of clusters is respectively equal to 10, 20, or 30% of the original number of executions. And we compared corroboration-based filtering to some other techniques. The two that I want to focus on are the simple strategy of simply reviewing all failures. That is, reviewing all executions that users have labeled as failures. And then we created a sort of artificial extension of that. We call the first technique RAF. We created a technique called RAF Plus, which basically randomly selects additional executions to review until the number of executions is the same as for CDF. That's so we could compare them fairly in terms of the total number of executions reviewed. For subject programs, we used the GCC compiler, the Java C compiler, and the JTidy pretty printer, or HTML pretty printer. And we used, as profiles, function call execution counts. So these are profiles which tell you for each function in the program how many times it was called on a particular execution. So they're large profiles that typically have thousands of elements in them. Our assumptions for the sake of the experiment are that each actual failure that's selected by the method for review would be discovered if a developer really reviewed it. And as I said, we also assume the developer, if they tried to debug the failure, would actually find its cause. Okay, so let me give you some sample results. This is a very typical set of results. It's for the GCC compiler. And basically what you see are the mean failures discovered over 100 iterations of the experiment. As the mislabeling rate increases from 0 to 20%. And the The top three lines at the top of the display are for corroboration-based filtering, and they're for different numbers of clusters. That's why there are three lines. But essentially what you see is the drop-off in failures discovered is much less steep for corroboration-based filtering than for review all failures and for review all failures plus, which is the one that artificially increases the number of executions reviewed, so the number reviewed is the same as the corresponding version of CVF. So that should be a fair comparison. So looking in the neighborhood to corroborate failures really works. It helps you avoid missing real failures. The results are extremely similar with the Java C compiler and with JTidy. Remarkably similar. Now, one thing you can see with all of these techniques is that this on the left hand, on the y-axis, you actually see the total number of failures in the population. And in all of the figures, all of these methods are doing pretty well. So even with 20% mislabeling, review all failures, which is the weakest technique, so to speak, in terms of its ability to discover failures, is still finding 125 failures out of a total of 155. So that's not too bad. But the drop-off is very slight for CVF. As you can see, it's about, 152 or so. Now, the downside, the mean executions reviewed. What this shows is that the average executions reviewed with these techniques as the mislabeling rate increases. And what you can see is the number of executions reviewed increases linearly for each of the methods. But it's the CVF methods are much more costly in terms of executions reviewed than review all failures is. How much more depends on the clustering, but they're considerably more, hundreds more. The best version of CVF in terms of executions reviewed here, which is with the 30% clustering, reviews a couple of hundred more executions than review all failures does. It's discovering failures that review all failures won't discover, even if it's artificially augmented with randomly selected additional executions, but you're doing a lot of work to find the failures. So we are looking at a new family of techniques, which is essentially intended to split the difference between corroboration-based filtering and review all failures. We call it RAF plus KNN. RAF plus k-nearest neighbors. And it essentially requires stronger evidence before a failure is reviewed than CVF does. In particular, it's not going to require you to review failures that are isolated in singleton clusters that haven't been labeled as failures by users. So these techniques require all executions with user label failure to be reviewed if a failure is confirmed, the k-nearest neighbors in the profile space are also reviewed, but isolated successes are not reviewed. So here are some results concerning RAF plus KNN, three versions, one nearest neighbor, three nearest neighbor, and five nearest neighbor. And they're compared here to CVF and to RAF. This is for another subject program, the Rome RSS parser. And actually, in this set of experiments, we use two different forms of mislabeling. The one on the left is called differential mislabeling. Basically, what it means is we're varying only the rate with which failures are mislabeled, and we're holding the mislabeling rate for successes at 0.01. And we think, in some cases, users with some applications, users may be much more likely to mislabel failures than they are to mislabel successes. On the right is the uniform mislabeling, where both failures and successes are mislabeled at the same probability. And in both cases, we're varying the mislabeling rate all the way to 0.5 now. And what you see with the differential mislabeling is that RAC plus KNN, this is in terms of executions reviewed, its cost is intermediate between corroboration-based filtering, which is the most expensive technique, and RAF, which is the cheapest technique. And the degree to which it's in the middle depends on K, of course. And RAF plus three nearest neighbors is right in the middle between the two. So you can see that, for example, RAF plus three NN is substantially cheaper in terms of executions reviewed than CVF is. Here on the y-axis, you actually have percentage of executions reviewed instead of the raw count, but it's basically the same type of figure as the ones I showed you previously. As far as failures discovered, again, RAF is right in the middle. Here you see that CVF suffers the least from increased mislabeling. It discovers almost all of the failures. But RAF plus three nearest neighbors and RAF plus five nearest neighbors is right up there with CVF. So indeed, RAF plus KNN finds, in this case, let's focus on RAF plus three nearest neighbors as a good example of the family of methods. It's finding almost as many failures as CVF is, but it's doing so with substantially fewer executions reviewed. Now, as far as underlying defects, there are all these methods on all our subject programs, and we've looked at five subject programs now. They're all finding almost all of the defects, but that's under the assumption of perfect debugging, which is that when you recognize the failure, you will always be able to diagnose the defect that caused it. Of course, that's not realistic, but it's hard to model what the actual debugging success rate is. So we didn't even attempt to do that. In actuality, it often helps debuggers to have multiple instances of failures caused by a given defect in order to debug it. But we don't know exactly how to model that, so as I said, we don't try. Okay, so we're continuing to study these techniques and variants of these techniques. And let me focus on one area of study that I think is particularly interesting, which is, as I said earlier, the assumption behind the results that I showed you, or the experiments that I showed you, is that you can't afford to miss very many failures because they could be extremely serious. But with consumer products that are not safety critical, not economically critical, let's face it, obviously the vendors are tolerating a lot of failures. And they would probably, we would have to complain a lot before they paid a lot of attention to us. So clearly they're going to want to be able to prioritize their inspection efforts, their review efforts. They're not going to want to review user-reported failures unless there's a very high probability, or a relatively high probability, let me say, that they're actually going to run into a real failure when they review it. And so it's natural to try to sort of weaken the criteria for reviewing a failure and actually come up with a number, a probability, or a prioritization of the failures that would have that property where if you reviewed the highest priority failures, the probability is relatively high that you'll discover a real failure. But if the probability or priority is lower, all bets are off. And you can probably imagine there's ways of generalizing the RAF plus KNN methods, and we're working on that. We're also looking at using some supervised and semi-supervised learners for the same purpose. And the initial results are promising that. We think we can come up with a reasonably good way of prioritizing executions for review that will have the desired property. And that's all I have. They're stupefied.
So I have a question, because you kept talking about profiles, but I think you're really using program spectrum, and you're looking at the profile and you're abstracting out of it these counts of the numbers of function a particular function is called, and that is your data that you're actually
comparing. When you're saying profile, I think you're talking about a trace.
Yes.
I've been consistent. Used the word profile.
So my
spectrum.
My question is, yeah. Are there other properties or is there other data in a trace besides this particular piece of data you chose for this study, which seems to be working well? What would be your next choice, perhaps? Could the methodology do better if you had two different extracted measurements from the trace and do you have ideas about that?
My idea is yes.
Okay.
That you could benefit from combining different sources of information, and we've looked at a number of different kinds of profiles in our other work. We've looked at basically many of the things listed here, basic blocks, traditional branches, we looked at information flows, etc., we looked at call sequences. They all work, but one interesting thing we found is as you get to extremely high granularity profiling, we've seen in some cases for related problems, not for this one particularly, we've seen that there's a point where there's no additional benefit to going to finer granularity, and we don't fully understand why that is. Mm-hmm. Function call profiles work remarkably well, and for some problems and some programs, you can't do better by going to finer granularity profiles. That may be because the techniques I'm talking about were completely unsupervised, and we were not able to do feature selection. If you have confirmed failures as well as confirmed successes, then you can use feature selection algorithms, throw out a lot of those profile features, keep the relevant ones, and then go on with your analysis. But for the unsupervised work, you can't do that, so there's a lot of noise. That's our best guesses about what's going on, but we're not sure. Yeah?
Can you use the long-running programs?
You reconceptualize. That's a good question. You have to decide on a unit of work. So if your long-running program is a server, then you take an individual request and response, and that's your unit of work. If your long-running program is an operating system, you're going to have to decide on some other unit of work, like the invocations of individual services and so forth. Otherwise, you're going to have to, limit your profiles to a block of time, and do your analysis based on blocks of time. Presumably, there's a way to do sort of a time series version of this, but I don't see any other way than to do a moving average, to have a window, sort of a sliding window profile that goes down the execution trace. Any other questions? Thank you.